Welcome to the Shamanism Global Summit, an extraordinary gathering of teachers and healers from around the planet, sharing insights, principles, and rituals for personal and collective healing and transformation. Please share this event with your friends and family, and come join us on Facebook at The Shift Network. And now your host, Michael Stone.
Well, welcome back, everyone. We're really happy you're joining us for this special session here. I'm with Herb One White Horse Standing Stevenson. He's a Shawnee Cherokee teacher and practitioner, and he's been exploring indigenous healing practices for over 30 years, and we're really happy to have you, Herb. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Let's just start out but with a little background about how you got your name and a little bit of your youthful days and where you grew up.
Okay. I grew up in actually a little small town called Covington, Ohio. Most people have never heard of it, but it's actually where most of the Indian Wars east of the Mississippi were fought. So that's where Tecumseh and Prophet, his brother, were at, and it's near Fort Greenville, and so most of the people there are, like myself, biracial, so that's why Shawnee and Cherokee is kind of unusual, but I also have some Irish and some German within me. Grew up there with, as I like to say, is some of the things we did in our family was not read, which is another way of saying is some of the practices we did within our household was not normal in the normal sense of today's society. An example that would be is that my father was a healer, and he actually had this amazing talent that he could blow fire out of a burn, so people would come to him and for an instant healing. And so I was raised that way and thinking that's normal. As I got older, I found out not everybody's father did that. So that's where I grew up. I was born 66 years ago come October.
So you've been around a bit. How did you end up with the name One White Horse Standing?
As I claimed my heritage and I started teaching, I was at a place called Dancing Shadows. And in Cherokee tradition, I didn't know this at the time, you're given your name by spirit frequently. And so three individuals at the workshop, one of them started interrupting me, and so I said, what can I do to help you? And she said, well, I've got to tell you this. And she proceeded to tell me this dream, and two other people said I had the exact same dream, and all three had the dream that I'd been named One White Horse Standing, and it stuck with me.
Sounds like a quorum to me.
Great. Yeah, pretty much. And then later when I met with a Cherokee elder, he told me, he says, oftentimes that's how names come to us in the Cherokee tradition. So that was the important part for me. And yeah. It's been that way now for going on 30 years has been my name.
Uh-huh. So you have a unusual kind of avocation or vocation, and he's working with time crystals and clearing the space frozen in time. What is that? Can you explain that to us?
It's evolved over the 30 years that I've been doing this work. Part of it was my own healing. I was always had this sense that there was something missing oftentimes when I would start trying to do some of my own healing work. And it was like I had a tear in my auric field. I feel like a part of me would just leave. And it always fascinated me that I could feel that experience of something leaving but not know where it went. So I described it as a tear in the aura or auric field. Over the years, I started practicing and doing more work. And started noticing that other people had the same experience where they left their body or they felt a sense of something tore and moved. So as I began to do more shamanic work and I learned about soul retrievals and things of this nature, I started noticing that there was something else going on, and it was like, well, okay, we go get these memories or these experiences of what we call soul loss. And one day somebody sent me an article that said there's this thing called time crystals where there's this, for whatever reason, this moment is frozen in time. It has no energy, but it seems to just float. And that I had an insight about it that led me to believe that these time crystals might be frozen memories. So it'd be the same place in some respects where people, where the shaman would go out to get a soul retrieval, and if they... they may not see it as a crystal, but they go into the memory and they bring it back in. From the work I do, and in Cherokee, we use rocks and crystals quite a bit. And so what I did was I started experimenting, and I thought, well, if this is true and this is floating out here, I tied that then to some other things I learned from Peter Levine, which is that we freeze memories in our bodies. So what if there's a frozen part correlated in our body to, let's say, this thing that's outside ourselves? And through that experimentation, what I found out was that there is this place where if I take a crystal and I work around, the person can tell me where to stop, and we just sit there and allow the energy of the crystal work with them, crystal meaning a quartz crystal. And the result of it is it starts to release this energy. And the interesting part is that I've explored this with several people, about 40 people now, and a lot of them have the same experience. As it dissolves, they can either feel a chill or a warming, one or the other. But it basically means that the crystal, the frozen crystal, is starting to thaw. Now, the interesting part for me when I do this, and I work with these folks, is that they are able to have, there's no trauma release, which is different than most situations. The result of it is the energy releases and the memory comes back. So I'll give you an example. Just one individual who we were working with this, and totally unbeknownst to her, a memory came back that she hadn't even had never thought about, and she was like 6 years old. She had been a vivacious young girl. She loved to sing, loved to do a lot of different things, and in her first experience at school, she was shamed quite a bit because she was too perky. She spoke too much. She sang too much, and it was almost like she was froze. She went right to that memory, and she had this pattern release that gave her a picture of her whole life of how that one incident had changed her. And when it dissolved, it was like it was a lifting and a freeing of it throughout her experience. So she had both an experience of a thawing, which is the cool sensation, and then she had a release of heat. And subsequent to that, her confidence and her willingness to be more out there, to be more public, has stayed with her. So that's an example of somewhat what it is and how it releases.
It's a good example. You use in a paper you wrote that I just read on time crystals, clearing the space frozen in time. You also liken it to a term I've only heard Eckhart Tolle use, really, and that's the pain body. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship of these incidents that are frozen in time, these time crystals in the auric field, and the pain body?
Yeah, I got that phrase from Eckhart as well, and there's a second piece to it I call the fear body. The pain body basically is the trauma that surrounds or protects the time crystal. In Jungian psychology, they would say that this is the part that prevents us from going re-traumatizing ourselves. So it's the pain body is this thing that holds us to this moment in time, not allowing us to be released. So what was fascinating about the time crystals and doing what I do is it dissolves that pain body, so there is no re-traumatization, there's no emotional outburst, there's just this sense of release. Now, pain body is a reactive process, from my experience, and the fear body is a preventive reaction or preventive approach that if I go out, I can go into my fear, whereas a pain body, the way I describe it is more of the emotional trauma. But in both cases, whether somebody's fearful to move forward because of a bad experience or fearful to go release the past, this keeps them fully present. And the way I've done the process now is to help them is I want them to be fully present in a participatory process. So instead of like in a traditional shamanic where you journey for somebody, we have one person standing in front that maintains eye contact and works with him. And you'll read in that paper that I'll make available to everybody. There's a tool that we've created that helps keep them fully present. And they have to participate. And then we have a person behind them, and sometimes it's two people, but they're moving around in the auric field until they feel a disturbance, and then they check in with the other individual. The result of the combination of it is by the person who's being, let's say, healed, is worked on. By staying fully present, there's no going back to the past in a negative or in a painful way. So it's having a healing field around them, having people helping them stay fully present, and as a result, the release occurs in present, in real time. So that's how that works together.
Does. Do we need to know what the trauma is that's frozen in time in order to release it? Do we actually need to re-experience that or at least know what it was?
No, none of that. That's been the fascinating piece about this because all the work I've done in the past is, you know, people say, well, I know I've got a soul loss, and they want to go recapture something, and that's one way to do it. But just like the example I said with the lady, she's 55 now and it was 6 years old, she had no recollection. When she went through it, she saw what she went through, but she did not re-traumatize herself. And that's what's fascinating about this. Is there's no re-traumatization, there's no re-experiencing of the past. It literally, as you dissolve the time crystal, and what happens, my visual experience of it shamanically is this sealed crystal, sealed energy dissolves, and the memory comes back into the field. So the way I describe it, instead of an event that haunts you, it becomes a memory that informs you how you became who you are today.
So talk a little bit about the tools you use. Crystals, I know you use some other stones. Mm-hmm. I forgot, obsidian or something. No, it wasn't obsidian, something like that, darkness. Talk about how you use the tools and the process that you go through when you're doing this.
When we were experimenting with it, what we found out is I attach a piece of jet to selenite. So jet has a property of when focused, they can release energy. So the intent shamanically is we take the pain body or the fear body, and it goes into the jet. From the jet, it goes into the selenite, which those who are familiar with selenite, it purifies so it can take the darkness out or the negative energies out and restore it back to what I call just simply pure life force. And so by doing it that way, that's how we're shamanically eliminating or taking away the pain body or the fear body. But it does not have to be, when we use this, what we found is if we have the person just be open and receptive, they're often surprised what comes up. But when it does come up, they can see the trail of what I call it is how it actually impacted their whole life. So those are the two core ingredients. I also, the thing that I put out that I'm going to make available, the PDF that you have, other people add other stones to theirs, and I like them to do that. So they may put jet with the selenite, might have a garnet or something else that's important to them. And I have them just trust themselves. And So the impact has been is there's a group in Wisconsin, there's a group in Ohio who've been practicing and having very good success, and they're recording their sessions about what's happening and going in with the intent of not healing anything, but just being curious about what surfaces and then explore it until it dissolves.
So that's a good point. Can you talk a little bit about the how you use intention and prayer in this healing process?
To me, intention and prayer are pretty much the same thing. We often, in religious terms, we use prayer for a variety of other things, but I use it from the point of view of we create sacred space, and our intention is to be open and hold the person in a sacred way, and not a whole lot more than that. If they want more than that, then some people will do a formal prayer and call in the light, or they may do some other things, but it's not been necessary. It's like we form through the use of the two or three people supporting the individual, it's almost like a sacred geometry is created. So the sacred space is the connection between them and their intentions to work together. So there's a connectivity there and an energetic connection for sure.
In your paper, you talked about the difference between time crystal work and the thawing work of the dragon medicine that Peter Levine talks about. You mentioned that. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, Peter's work got me interested because in Taming the Tiger, he's talking about how we freeze the trauma in our body and it's in the cellular tissue. And I agree with that completely, but my experience was, I'm frozen in my body, but there's an energetic something out here that left, and that's where soul retrieval connection comes in. Well, what we found out is that we can do the physical release in the cellular memory is one way or approach to do the healing like Peter does, or you can do soul retrieval, and that's another way to do it. And what Time Crystal is trying to do is unite the two. Because what ends up happening is the person feels the energetic connection between their body tissue and whatever else that we're touching in their auric field. And so there's somehow this connection, which I haven't fully figured out yet, but once the time crystals dissolve, the body relaxes as well. And that's how the two tie together.
Yeah, in traditional soul retrieval, of course, the person's eyes are closed generally. There's drumming or music, and the practitioner goes in, after diagnosing the loss of essence or soul part that's suppressed, goes in and finds that and brings it back. And you were talking about having the eyes open and looking into other people's eyes, I think, or making eye contact. Well, what's the role of the eye contact, and how is that, how does that make it different? And
a couple ways that ties together. One is the eye contact is I want the person fully present. Because the problem with most trauma is if their eyes go up or their eyes go down, they're moving back to that place in time where the trauma occurred. And for people familiar with trauma trance will know what I'm talking about. The person literally is it's almost like they vacated and went back to that place in time. And so the idea of keeping them fully present is the healing from a medicine wheel point of view is can only happen in the moment, in the present. It can't happen in the past, and it can't happen in the future, because the only thing we truly actually control is the present. So keeping them fully present, right here, staying connected and working with it, it prevents falling into a pain body or falling into a fear body. And so that's the reason for it, is I'm really trying to keep them present. But the second piece of it is my belief is this: if I really want healing, I need them to fully participate. And what I didn't like as well is the shamanic model in many respects is very similar to the modern medical model, which is somebody has to be an expert and heal me, work on my behalf to heal me. I'm trying to create a participatory process, one where the person is actually fully involved, has complete buy-in because they can't deny their experience and they know they remain fully present. So the result of that is it seems to be long-term results. In other words, it wasn't a nice experience that might have shifted something. It's something that truly shifted the process and moved them forward.
So what you're trying to do is keep them in an expanded state of awareness as you're doing the process.
Mm-hmm.
So I love what you say about the participation, because as someone who's done soul retrievals a lot and knows many people who do soul retrievals, that's one of the key issues, is that people want to be fixed and they come, expecting a magic cure. One of the things that happens is they might even be cured from cancer or something like that, but without their participation, that tends to come back. What keeps the time crystal process that you do, what allows that? I mean, do you keep people participating in this process afterwards, or how do you involve them after the initial treatment that you do?
Well, when we do it, one of the things we ask them to do is pay attention to what's different. I don't guide them in it. I don't come back beyond simply saying to them is okay. You know, you had an experience. You might have had an immediate memory, or sometimes people have it a few days later. But what I want them to do is track the memory, which is to allow themselves to unfold how that event that's frozen in time impacted their life and who they became. And just that receptivity of paying attention to what am I doing differently than I noticed I would normally do. And it's interesting because most people get it right away. They start realizing, I used to, in a certain situation, I would defer to somebody else, and I'm not doing that. I'm staying fully present. So they notice a difference in just being fully present. I just check in with them by email, and I suggest that they journal, just paying attention to what's different, what's unusual, what's different in their reactions. The result of that has been that people have come back and said that they've had, they feel different. They feel different in their skin. They feel more present. They feel more alive. They feel more aware.
Is this a process that anybody can learn how to do? And if so, how do they learn that?
I'm showing people. I'm teaching it. How to do it through workshops that I do. I'm doing it right now in Ohio, and I do them in Wisconsin. It's listed on my website, but I'm teaching people how to do it, how to make the healing crystals, the time crystal tools, and then we practice. And then there's nothing better than actually practicing, because when you experience it yourself, and then you go through the various roles. So you might be the person who's holding space in front of the person, or you might be the one. It's been interesting because some people call them they're the flagger. They come across it, or somebody says, I'm the anchor. But it doesn't matter to me what metaphor they're using. Is each person feels all the parts as well as the one being healed. And the result of it is they have a complete sense of the whole process. And then they can do it. Now, it can be done occasionally with just one individual, a shamanic practitioner. But I found out it helps to have a couple of aides. It's kind of like it builds a bigger space, healing space.
Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about the role of lineage, ancestors and descendants, and healing, and often what the information I receive is that when we heal a trauma in present time, it also clears it up for ancestors as well as future descendants. How do you see that in your cosmology?
I agree with that. The issue that I work with people is the first thing I ask them is when we're working with this is, you know, where is this at in your life? And if they can pinpoint, and often they can pinpoint a time, then this is something that happened in this lifetime. It may have trailings to the past, but it's something that happened in this lifetime. If it's beyond that, that feels nondescript, it's like there's not a specific moment, then it has the potential to go back and be an ancestral wound that's been passed, you know, up to six generations or seven generations. And then when I'm developing a new workshop, it'll be coming out in October, that is for that purpose, is to expand this beyond present life application into past life, which then, you know, applies to the seven behind and seven in front generation.
Yeah. So let's see, what was I just had a thought and was so involved in what you were saying, I forgot what it was. But I'm looking at the state of the world right now, and obviously there's a great change, a great turning. It's been prophesized by many different cultures, and many people are very dissociated. There's huge amounts of soul loss. How could you explain or come up with any other idea of how, you know, we could be killing people for oil and greed and not having life itself be sacred? So I'm just wondering how, you know, on the larger field, the community and the human field, the human sphere, how can this help for people to begin to get out of that numbness that seems to be happening and actually find their own, whatever purpose they were born into to be on this planet right now?
Well, that was part of what originally evolved for me. People would tell me I need to get grounded, and I had no idea what they were talking about. So I think, you know, grounding is a critical piece, and I think a lot of people in their bodies, it's very painful for them. And in fact, they don't even know what the phrase grounded means. They think if their feet's touching the ground, they're in it, and they don't know that they should be feeling sensation. They can actually feel energy flowing up and down their legs and in different parts of their body. Pardon me. But they also need to know that it's not just about being grounded, it's being fully embodied. So when you said dissociated, I think that's fairly accurate. There's a lot of people out there who have, let's just say, gone into trance about this is who I'm supposed to be, and this is what I do, and I'm not paying attention to a whole lot of the other things. I'm just kind of stuck in Native terms, what we call Manitou, which is this energy that, as you say, is killing for oil or doing these various other things. I haven't expanded the time crystal process out further enough yet to do that, but I've been experimenting with sacred space. So I'll tell you an example of something that I did once, and I still do this in most workshops. I built very large altars, bringing rocks and crystals and minerals anywhere from 800 to 1,200 pounds with the intention of building a five-mile radius. And I was in the Detroit suburb a few years back, and it was, I think it was Halloween night on a full moon. And they were asking me, what's the impact of this very large altar I bring? And I said, well, it should create a calm stability in about a five-mile radius. And they all said, oh, okay. And, you know, it's more like, oh yeah, sure. One lady went home that night from the workshop, and I didn't know this. She was an emergency room nurse. And she came back the next day, and she told me, she says, you know, I thought you were full of shit when you told us that. And I said, so what are you saying? And she says, well, I work in an emergency room in our hospital on a full moon on Halloween. It's the busiest time we ever have. We have gunshots, car wrecks, everything. She said, we had no patients last night.
That's pretty good. That reminds me, can you give us some more examples of the kind of impact? That's a very startling measurement of something, because anybody who's ever been around an emergency ward knows that that's emergency room knows that that's true. Are there any other kind of scientific evidences or measurements or things that people could wrap their head around to say, wow, this is really a powerful process?
Well, part of it is, and it's interesting that a lot of people say that, you know, you shouldn't be using it, but clear back in even in the Bible, refers to this, of how they used quartz crystals and various stones for sacred ceremonies because it raised vibrations. So one of the things that scientific that you can do yourself, it's more of an experiential action research, but if people would sit for 5 minutes a day with a quartz in each of their hands and just allow themselves to get quiet, by the end of 30 days, they would find out they would feel better. They would feel more energized. The crystal itself starts getting very warm. In fact, if you put it now from your hand to your cheek, you would realize, goodness, the crystal is hotter than my skin temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is it begins to prove to you there's actually an exchange of energy that's constantly going on between us and everything else, and then crystals just happen to be one of those things that the body attunes to very, very quickly. It also supports going into a deep meditative state very quickly. That's why the people who are attracted to rocks, you know, they can't get enough of them, because it does affect our fields. And for me, it was one of those things that, until I was about 38, I didn't really do much with it. My father did all the time. He was forever trying to get me to do stuff with him, and I just didn't have an interest in him. One day, I suddenly, like, the light bulb clicked on, and I suddenly began to feel and experience them. And that would be the thing that I would suggest that people do just as a starting point. It's very dramatic. Those who do it for 30 straight days tell me, something shifted. I feel better. I got more energy, because the crystal actually raises the life force, our chi, and quiets the mind, which is like resting, and so it rejuvenates us. Beyond that, things that I've done, I've built a 20-foot medicine wheel made out of rocks, crystals, and minerals as a kind of like an altar or vortex, where I also do a lot of work, and I have people come and have experiences and do things on that, and I show them how to build their own. They don't have to do it quite the way I do it, but I've had people from Europe come in and had a profound experience and go back and build their own version as a Celtic cross.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm wondering. Go ahead.
No. What was that?
Well, I was just going to ask, I'm wondering how in your culture, the Shawnee Cherokee culture, if you're continuing to be associated with them, and what the people in the tribal people think of the work you're doing. How do they see it? Do they see it as you're doing your medicine? Or what?
I'm not doing a whole lot of direct work with either group. I was highly involved here in Cleveland with the American Indian Education Center, which was one of the primary services to the Native population here. It's since dissolved. Or at least downsized completely from where it was. My primary contact is J.T. Garrett. He's one of the top Cherokee writers. He and his son write quite a bit. And he and I associate a lot and work together and talk quite a bit about it and share information. He's the one, the elder, that helped me understand how my name came about, and then he said, you know, we don't have a lot of teachers at our core. And I said, what do you mean by that? And And he says, well, whatever has become your strength, which mine has been rocks and crystals, he says, is usually given to you by spirit. It's kind of like you're suddenly drawn to it and you don't know why and you keep doing it. He's very helpful in helping me understand the process I went through, because that's exactly what it was. Every time I'd go find a teacher, there was suddenly some reason why they either we couldn't get together and it didn't work. So I stay in contact with certain individuals. There's quite a few people I've supported to find their heritage, and I help them find their teachers. If I'm one, I work with them. If people are trying to learn about their Cherokee heritage, I send them to JT down to his spirit circle in Cherokee, North Carolina. Other than that, I'm kind of quiet. I'm like my father, in the sense is that, you know, these things are part of us, but we don't really, beyond those who are interested and receptive, we don't really talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. Well, we're getting close to our end of our time here. I just wanted to say, given what we have talked about today, what's something that you'd like to leave us with today, kind of a next step for listeners to use this kind of thing as to make changes in their own life?
The thing that I tell everybody, or that I would want them to recognize is that they have to decide how old they have to be before they can give themselves permission to be the person they fully are. Most of our teachings growing up is telling us who we're supposed to be or should be. Mm-hmm. And it's when we make a commitment to ourselves that I'm allowed to create who I am and how I am in the world, we begin to actually return and explore the spiritual traditions in whatever form that may be for them. And it's not a blank check, so to speak, to just go create something, because it's not that simple. But it is giving yourself permission to go explore and find out who you are. And the way I phrase that, there's a quote, and I don't know who it was related to, but it basically says, fate is not what happens to us. It's who we are if we were true to ourselves.
That's beautiful. Well, that's a great note to bring this together. I just want to thank you, Herb One White Horse Standing Stevenson, for taking the time for us today to be on this amazing summit that we've got, and just appreciating the work. My thanks for all of us at the Shift Network and for all of us that are listening to this broadcast. It's been really good to get to know you and know a little bit about your work. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me, and I truly have enjoyed it, and I hope it's been supportive to other people.
I hope so, too. I think for sure it has. So many blessings, Herb. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Shamanism Global Summit, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community who are awakening to their divine humanity and taking inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the entire Shamanism Global Summit collection of teachers and healers, or to add all these interviews to your personal library, visit shamanismsummit.com/upgrade. Thank you again for gathering with us and for sharing this empowering path with your friends and family.